back to Making the Turn. Joining me now is Hal Phillips. He's a partner with Mandarin Media. It's a media, PR, and IT firm. Offices in Saigon, Singapore, Park City, and Portland, Maine. Hal has spent 20-plus years in the allied media fields, all of them as a working sports and travel journalist. He was a founding editor of Golf Course News and has contributed to, well, every major publication that covers golf that I've ever seen. He currently blogs for the A Position and has served, and I'm jealous, on Golf Magazine's Top 100 Course Rating Panel since 1998. You played anything good, Hal?
Oh, since 1998, a few.
I mean, that's a racket. I mean, I know a little bit about it, but for our audience, tell them what that ends up meaning in terms of being on that panel and how you get access.
Well, I would never use the word racket. I want to be clear on that. But
that was my word.
No, I was invited to join it, I guess, in 98 or so, and I think it was a function of my having played a lot of golf in some places where maybe they don't have a lot of raters, Asia being one of them, but also England and Europe. But you sort of have to get around and see a lot, and I've done a lot of work with course architects and do a lot of work, you know, writing on design issues, so I don't know. Who knows? They asked me, and I said yes.
Jack Nicklaus told some folks recently that last year the portion of his income derived from building golf courses in the United States as a percentage of the whole was 0.003. I'm guessing that doesn't particularly shock you.
No, it's really fallen through the floor, the entire course development market. And if you're going to develop courses, you need architects to design them. And all that work is happening outside of North America or the United States for sure.
Now, what is the economic situation in some of what has become new hotbeds? Are these sustainable growths, or are they shaky in some places?
Well, they're new. And when a market is new, a lot of golf courses are built for a lot of different reasons, and some succeed and some don't. So in that sense, I guess they're not as stable as a market like the U.S. market had been for the last 30 years, where there were tried and true formulas for building golf courses that made money and attracted members and sold real estate and what have you. In Asia, there are pockets of markets that do all those things, and they're, you know, I think everyone's waiting to see what really flies. The one thing they're not doing is pinning so much of their hopes on the real estate aspect. They're not depending so much, you know, not as much as we did, for example, on selling homes with the golf course. The golf is more often an amenity to a larger development that, you know, isn't going to, you know, make or break based on whether that golf course succeeds or not.
You know, one of the trends that we, of course, have seen in media is we've seen some print magazines close. We've seen some great people having to scramble for new work. We've seen the introduction of these digital magazines on Monday morning, the Global Golf Post. Golf World has one. Golf Week has one now. Golf Magazine has its Monday Confidential. What's your reaction to the digital magazines and what their future is like, and how much you think they'll change their format?
I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how Rupert Murdoch's new digital-only publication does. I think everyone in media, in golf and outside media, is wondering how the digital model really works. What's for sure is that, you know, none of the dollar figures that you used to get for a page of advertising in Golf World or Golf Week, you can't get that online. What you can get is a smaller sum for a page of, you know, advertising in a sort of a digital flipbook type magazine, but it's not as much. But what you do have is you have social media strategies that sort of treat, you know, the readership of a magazine like a big community. I come from the trade press, or I worked a long time in it, where you had instead of trying to design a magazine for everybody who played golf, Golf Course News, where I was editor, had a readership of, you know, 25,000-30,000 people who worked in the business, in the golf business, and they didn't really want anybody else because these were the people who made decisions about buying stuff. And in that way, I think magazines have an opportunity to treat this little niche readership, you know, as something unto itself and communicate with it in a way that, you know, you could never do through print. So I think that's the hope, but it's hard to know, you know, how these guys are going to make money if it's purely derived from advertising. That doesn't seem like a viable strategy any longer.
One of the interesting things, it seems to me, Hal, about having parity at this moment in the men's game, to be specific, is that it has an effect on television ratings. I mean, it's one thing when you've got Freddie Couples hanging around for the weekend, bad Sunday or no, but he's attractive to television audiences. But with parity, television's got to be a concern for people in television.
I certainly would be concerned. I watched the tournament over the weekend. Riviera is just a great golf course. I love looking at it. That's how much I like it. But they had a good crowd there, and I think they do draw well. And I think there are certain, you know, marquee events that aren't majors that still draw pretty well. But, you know, if you turn on a senior tour event or an LPGA event, I mean, there's nobody there. If it's held in North America, and that's got to be really frightening when you pan the crowd and there is no crowd. It looks like a made-for-television exhibition, even more than maybe it is in reality. Again, they're treating, I think the Golf Channel and other televised golf broadcasts are looking for that small slice of the population that plays golf and has a lot of buying power, but, geez, can you really spread that over 3 tours, 4 tours? You know, can they really support it? It's hard to imagine, and it doesn't look like it's happening right now. What do you think?
Well, what about the secondary tours as well? I mean, you've got the Hooters Tour, you've got the eGolf Tour, you've got a number of these satellite things, and those don't seem to be suffering as much. Does that make any sense?
Not to me, but I don't follow those tours like maybe you do. I mean, do they actually draw crowds?
There's nobody. There's nobody there. If there's nobody at the Champions Tour, there's nobody,
no.
You know, at the ones that we know less about. You know, and that, of course, is problematic. It's incredible when you've got Fred Couples and Bernhard Langer and you've got Crenshaw out there and so many good players there's 4 or 5 fans behind the greens. How is that a sustainable economic model?
I don't know, but you think about the reaction to televising sporting events going way back into the 50s and 60s when they started doing it for baseball. There were a lot of clubs that banned, local television broadcasts because they felt it affected the gate. You could argue, I suppose, that, when the senior tour goes to Florida, you're so used to seeing every tournament on television now, the need to go and watch it in person has been diminished. But there's also just so many events. It may just be straining, the number of core golf fans who can really afford it or have the time to go see it. That's a tough one. I mean, that's one of the things that's striking about the Asian game is that they support these tournaments wildly. And, part of that, I think, is just an innate interest in the game that's very strong. And part of it is that, they're not inundated with opportunities to see events like we have been the last 10 years.
What kind of support does that get? I mean, are we talking about really significant crowds, 3 and 4 deep at these events?
Oh, yeah. And I think they just held the season-opening LPG event in Thailand at Siam Country Club, and they had excellent crowds there, and they always do. I'm talking 20,000, 25,000 people every day. And I think Tiger had an exhibition in Bangkok in November, if I'm not mistaken, and Vijaygas was there, and Paul Casey, and Tongchai Jaidi, who's the top Thai player. I mean, the place was packed. Maybe that's a bad example because, Tiger's such a draw, and so is Jaidi in Thailand. But, when they have an event there, people turn out because I think it's still novel. But the other things that are in place in Asia are they've got to warm the hearts of golf executives and TV executives in Asia because, the corporate money is there and they're supporting these events in their own way. So they're getting on television and they're being promoted properly. And you think back to, that formula here in the States is so complicated. You look at the Hartford Open, which always drew so well, and yet they almost were run off the PGA Tour because they couldn't find a title sponsor a few years back before the Travelers stepped in. You remember that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, a number of great events were scrambling at the last minute.
And I think they've lost some events because they couldn't find, corporate sponsorship, even though they were very well supported, in terms of the gate. So, you know, are those priorities in order? I think in some places they're not.
What, you know, the moral code in many parts of Asia is tougher than what can be our liberal one here of forgive and forget and second chances. What do people there think about Tiger now?
I don't think they hold a grudge in that way, if you're talking about sort of a puritanical attitude toward him. I don't see that. He's still a big star. I think that the idea of holding people up in the way that we held Tiger up for so long, only to, you know, disappoint us eventually, as anybody would, I don't think that's as strong in Asia. I think that they're, especially the Buddhist culture, is more live and let live to a certain extent. And, you know, maybe, I can't prove it, but maybe they are able to segment their interest more effectively, meaning, you know, obviously this guy's a great golfer. It doesn't mean he's any kind of moral icon. I haven't seen any diminishment in his popularity there. He's still a huge draw. And I think, actually, you know, to be fair, it's come back here as well, don't you think?
It's tough to tell. I think he makes a lot of mistakes that would be so easy to fix. You know, you think of Augusta National last year, and he finishes the round. It's his first tournament back. You know, and he says, you know, basically, this sucks that I'm not winning, and couldn't wait to get out of there. All he had to do was say, it's great to be back. I'm really upset that I'm not going to win because I expect to win every time. But congratulations to Phil and his family. Well earned. If it's those kinds of things that you would think he would have father figures or mentors telling him to say, that would help incredibly enormously, it seems to me.
I think you're right. But I think one of the things that is attractive about Tiger is that when it comes to his competitive nature and the way he expresses it, even as, you know, automatically as he does sometimes, he's very honest. And I think he was being honest with whoever it was who was interviewing him that day after the match. He was pissed off that he hadn't, you know, played better and had a chance to actually win and didn't. And, you know, that's the overriding thing with him. I think if you could get him to kowtow to the media in a more, you know, productive, congenial way, yeah, it would help him. But, geez, I don't know that he really cares that much about that anymore. He is who he is, and, for you know, we can see for better and worse.
You know, you've got to think that he's a particularly sensitive guy, just as most people are. And, you know, when you're walking from that green to that next tee where there are very few people behind the ropes, you hear, as Greg Norman said recently, he said, you hear the comments. He said, you can ignore the stuff on the golf course, you know, in the main part of the course, because there's so many people. But, you know, and those are the kinds of things, the moments that Tiger could use where people say, hey, you know, love the attitude, keep it up, go get him. I don't feel that because he's not doing anything to try to connect, and maybe you're exactly right. Maybe he doesn't care about that. I don't know the answer to that.
It's hard to, I don't really, you know, even before all the whatever came down, he wasn't an interactive sort of cuddly guy. He went about his business, and I think he probably is treating it exactly the same way, and it's coming off as being a little churlish now. But is there really been a big difference in the way he acts towards those people, whether they're encouraging him or giving him a hard time?
No, but now he needs them, and he didn't need them before. That's what I'm feeling.
Needs them to be more competitive, or needs them for larger, you know, marketing, you know, cuddliness?
I think both. I think that you play well, better. I think he has played better when he's had support, even though he's played very well when he's been angry historically, but that anger has been sort of hyper-focused on somebody like a Stephen Ames, who made a loose comment about Tiger's game at one point that he was beatable, and then, you know, right, Tiger runs the table and beats him 9-8. But, you know, I think both. I think an overall perception where parents can say, you know what, people make mistakes. Tiger made some. But you know what? He's trying to be a nicer guy, and that's a great lesson to be learned. And right now, there isn't trying to be a nicer guy stuff. And I think when people are encouraging you, you probably play better.
Yeah. I think he's a tough guy to quote-unquote handle if you're trying to advise him in these ways. And I thought that, you know, I'm not claiming this to be my own idea, but I've heard it, and I think it's true, that I think if he had come out when everything finished up, or at least came to some kind of resolution and said, you know what, I got married too young, and just sort of left it at that, I think people would be a lot more understanding of a situation, because I think everyone's been there. And he obviously was too young and not ready. And a lot of this stuff would have sort of dissolved faster. But, you know, it's all guesswork. Who knows?
I've been telling my wife that for 30 years. I got married too young. Good to be with you, my friend.
Thank you, Peter.
Been enjoying your stuff on the A position. Thanks for showing up today. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it anytime.
My pleasure. That's Hal Phillips, a partner with Mandarin Media. You can find his work at the A position. You just go ahead and log into his site, which is HalPhillips.net. We'll be right back.